I had a very interesting, conversation with a senior U.S. diplomat, and I wanted to understand what animates U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, and especially insofar as Israel is concerned. And I got a very enlightening response. I was told in one line, for America, this is a domestic issue. Mm-hmm. So the point here is that the question of Israel for Americans is as much an issue about healthcare, about unemployment or employment and the economy and so on. It's deeply ingrained in the American body politic. And so if you understand and appreciate that reality about Israel, mm-hmm. you will then understand why American leadership from both parties, will throw overboard even their own laws, such as the laws that regulates the transfer of weapons to conflict zones, which strictly prohibits the United States government from transferring those weapons to Israel. Yet they have found ways of continuing to do that. And so what I'm saying to you is that I think in the final analysis, if we appreciate the fact that for America, Israel is a domestic issue, we will understand why then it's easy for them, get rid of any inhibitions they may insofar as that is concerned.
Mm-hmm. All right. Meantime, displaced Palestinians in central Gaza mm-hmm. have reacted with anger and surprise at Netanyahu's speech to the U.S. Congress. Instead of any overtures towards a ceasefire, more bloodshed was touted. Let's hear a little of what people said in Gaza.
He did not mention ceasefire or anything. He wants to continue with what he's doing to kill and destroy the Palestinian people. He wants to wipe out resistance, but he cannot do that, so he's wiping out the Palestinian people.
I was surprised. Netanyahu has not changed since two decades. He is a vampire who kills children and women. We were expecting Netanyahu to declare a truce, a ceasefire in the American Congress. The Congress applauded him, which means that Netanyahu is ruling the world. This is what I see. The world is not ruling Israel, but Israel is ruling the world.
All right, Ali, you heard the word ceasefire several times in those two soundbites, residents in the enclave. What is standing in the way of a ceasefire from taking hold or be agreed upon at this point, in your opinion?
At the moment, I think in the last 9 or 10 months, you've seen that America has a certain position. So has the West, the UK, Germany, and I don't think that there is any there can be any flexibility for that to move. So even these empty talks, empty narratives of ceasefire, even when they come, they bear no value, no power, no force. Mm-hmm. I think they're just a bit of smoke screens behind which everything is exactly the same, but they need to kind of, delusionize people, delusionize the social kind of a political imagination and consensus of that. So I think ceasefire is far from Netanyahu's own personal agendas and interest. I don't think
he himself, of course, is one big obstacle to it.
Sorry?
Netanyahu himself is an obstacle to
We could argue that it's not just Netanyahu. I think the fact that majority in Israelis are continuing to be pro-war, it just kind of illustrates where the psyche is at the moment in terms of what, is it genocide, is it war, which is justifiable. Even now when you hear most of the presenters on the radio and other political analysts, I think there is quite an openness about questioning still the nature of the war, whether it's genocide or it's just war. It happens in war. So still, I think majority is thinking within those frameworks that it's just a war and we have to accomplish certain goals and mm-hmm. objectives, and mm-hmm. that's for the interest of the Israelis' well-being. So I think unless that is broken, fractured, I don't think that we are going anywhere near it.
Okay. Tsetsu, I'm sure you listened to watch this speech by Netanyahu at the UK US Congress. He was almost obsessed with the Islamic Republic of Iran in his speech. He named Iran 10 times, I guess. And that is who he really wants a direct confrontation with. Is that right?
Yes and no. Yes, he wants a direct confrontation with Iran, but not with Israeli with the Israeli military. What he's looking for is essentially to draft the U.S. military into a war with Iran. You see, that will do two things for Netanyahu and his ilk. The one is they hope to forever bury, obliterate the Palestinian question on the one hand. But the second leg of this strategy of a confrontation with Iran will also then, essentially they hope destroy Israel's nemesis in the region. Because if you look at the geopolitical picture within the Middle East, Western powers, and in particular the United States, is essentially on the cusp of achieving what they've always set out to achieve, which was to elevate Israel as a regional power in West Asia. Mm-hmm. That, of course, will serve U.S. geostrategic interests. And so what has emerged over the years, of course, is two things. One is the Arab and Muslim governments in the Middle East, of course, have been brought to heel. They can be managed. And we've seen that with the Abraham Accords on the one hand.
Right.
The obstinate, the stubborn problem that simply refuses to go away is the Islamic Republic. And so if they are able then to do that and get the American military to obliterate the Islamic Republic, Israel will of course emerge as the winner. Hopefully, I think, establish itself as a regional hegemon. I think that is really the geopolitical strategy mm-hmm. that we are seeing. And the problem, though, for Netanyahu is neither the West, the collective West,
yeah.
And in particular the United States is particularly enthusiastic about getting into a direct confrontation with the Islamic yeah. Republic.
And, of course, another argument is that Netanyahu and his gang have lost the war, so-called, in the Gaza Strip, and that Iran is not at war, and its aligned groups in the region, the Ansarullah in Yemen, Hezbollah in Lebanon, and others, are keeping Israel in check. Now, the U.S.-led war on Gaza is likely to get much worse if white supremacist Donald Trump is elected as the U.S. president later this year. But would a black woman, Kamala Harris, be any better? We asked an economic and political activist based in New York for his analysis.
Well, she's been extremely rabid, foaming at the mouth, zealot Zionist. At least this is the way she's been projecting herself when she was the district attorney of California and later becoming a senator. And I remember she was selected during a Wall Street fundraiser to be the vice president. Nobody wanted her. Not even in her own state she wanted to vote. That's how horrible she is. Kamala Harris is basically what they would call here white supremacy in blackface. Like the same policies, the same imperialism, anti-poor, anti-worker, anti-Arab, anti-black. They just get a black person to do it. So she'll be another link in the chain of imperialism. There's not going to be any change. It might get worse, if that's even possible.
We also asked Erebus Abzulamashtu what the way forward for America is and if there ever will be change for the better.
Well, Zionism is an ideology. And like any ideology, it has an emotional sort of religious connection to it. It's very emotional. And, I like to say that in America, we live in a country of 100 million activists, but nobody wants to take power. And without power, change is not possible. Like, for instance, I'm part of a whatever was left of the People's Party. And we chose last year, back in June, we selected Cornel West to be the president. And in less than a week, right, he ran off to another party who's focusing on identity and not working class issues and not trying to end wars. So we have a problem of people who want to be on YouTube and do live streams and do all of this stuff and yell in the streets. And those things are tools and they're useful. But we don't have a George Galloway, for instance. We don't have a workers' party here. And you know, until people get serious and take power and sit there at the table where they can determine the policies, we're not going to get anywhere here. Right? And they know that. We have a situation where the majority of the population is focused on identity to the exclusion of everything else. It's all identity politics and culture wars, which cannot be won. So Zionism here is just another identity, another culture war. So until we get serious people to come in and take power and fight the establishment from without and from within, you know, the apparatus, you know, I don't see any prospects here of thing changing. I mean, Jackson Hinkle started a communist party with Haz al-Din. Hopefully it gets somewhere. But other than that, I don't think it's going to improve at all.
At the third Genocide in Gaza symposium hosted by the Bristol Palestine Alliance, we caught up with one of the speakers, Professor David Miller. We asked for his reaction to the ICJ ruling that the Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands is illegal, if the ruling held any weight, and what the likely next step was.
Yes, it's a legal ruling, and of course the problem, as you say in your question, is whether anyone's going to pay any attention to it. And it looks like people aren't going to pay attention to it. Of course, it's been rejected by the Israelis and by other governments. But look, the point here is that this is a step-by-step process which marginalises and puts into a corner the Zionists and all of their supporters. Step by step, we put them more and more into a corner which they can't get out of. And so, it's obviously it's welcome in that respect because it helps other people to say, well, actually, there's a clear ruling here in terms of international law. What does it say about David Lammy, the Foreign Secretary of the UK, who went and shook hands with Netanyahu in advance of this happening, who has previously said that he's in favour of international law? Well, it puts him in a very difficult position. And that's the kind of incremental way in which this will hype up the pressure on the governments, the states who are supporting the genocide. But at a wider level, of course, it's quite small as a step forward. It is a step forward, but we're also facing a multitude of other steps forward. Obviously, there is global public opinion, but the attempt by the Zionists to escalate in both Lebanon and in Yemen is an attempt which will certainly bring escalation. The Ansarullah and indeed Hezbollah have said that they will significantly respond to these provocations and further steps up what they call the escalation ladder. And of course, this is a desperate situation for the Zionists. They're playing really their last card because what they want is to bring the US in on their side. But the US is reluctant and will be reluctant because, of course, the US knows that it can't easily triumph in such a conflict because they know perfectly well that Ansarullah and indeed Hezbollah have weaponry which can sink US aircraft carriers, and that's why, of course, they've withdrawn one of their aircraft carriers, which was damaged by missiles, which they pretended was just due to come to the end of its 90-day mission. It hadn't even been there 90 days. So there's a real difficulty for the US because these are much vaunted projections of US power, the aircraft carriers and the associated warboats. They're essentially been transformed by the weaponry which Hezbollah and Ansarullah have into floating metal targets in the sea.
Professor David Miller speaking there. Well, we have just a few moments left to the end of the show. Let's get a couple of questions in there. And if I may, I will start with Tetsetsu. South Africa called on the ICJ back in May to order Israel to end the Rafah offensive. That never happened. Should we be optimistic about any new diktats from the International Court of Justice?
No, certainly not. These institutions have shown themselves to be impotent. You know, they have no impact whatsoever because you see in international relations, especially in the global governance institutions, is that it is typically only the West that will put their resources behind the enforcement of certain decisions, whether it's the UN Security Council or even the WTO and other institutions. And so you have that dynamic that is there within these global governance institutions. But I think for us, at the end of the day, in spite of the lack of action or the impotence of these institutions, the struggle continues. But I think there should be one fundamental shift in our focus of struggle, which is we have to focus not only on Israel as an occupier, as an apartheid state, but we should also equally focus our energies on the United States, without which or without whom we know Israel's genocide, for instance, now, would never have taken place and would never have persisted for this long. And so whether it's a Kamala Harris or a Donald Trump that emerges, to us as activists, and certainly for the Palestinian people, their fundamental grievances remain, and the struggle must continue. But then we have to adjust.
Let me pick up on that and put a question to Ali, and that is, you heard the analysis there from Johannesburg and, of course, from New York. Do you think Donald Trump is the guy that the Israelis under this government are looking for as president of the U.S.?
Yes, quite now a popular consensus on that Netanyahu is actually waiting for Donald Trump to, get into the government so that they can have a complete, free pass to just do
carte blanche.
Yeah, carte blanche to continue. Even if Donald Trump is not elected, even with Kamala Harris, we can see that, there's the kind of narrative is there which shows sympathy for the people in Gaza and Palestinians, but there is nothing that is, one can kind of infer that from their policies or their actions, anything can ever be in support of Palestinians. So, it's just a different kind of an expressions of Americans' position, but the position nevertheless never changed and will not change.
Will not change. All right, we're going to have to leave it there, gentlemen. That is all for this Gaza Under Attack. Special thanks to Ali Azam and Tisetsu Magama, and of course to you. Till we meet again, continue to keep Palestine in your hearts.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
الله يا الله سبحان الله الله يا الله والحمد لله الله ولا إله إلا الله الله يا الله والله أكبر.
This is part of Imam Khomeini's speech and recommendations to preachers, reciters of elegies and mourners. Obviously, the loss of a perfect man or the martyrdom of a perfect man is a thing of beauty in the eyes of the divine authorities, not because the person had fought and was killed, rather because the fighting had been for Allah and so was uprising. It is necessary that the atrocities, cruelties, and tyrannical acts of the arrogant of all ages be emphasized in full in the elegies, eulogies, and lamentations made in honor of the infallible Imams, especially
in the present age, which is the age of innocence of the world of Islam as oppressed by America and Russia and their dependents.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear audience. Welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from IURIB English Radio. You know, about the subject of the month of Muharram, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said, "They killed the doyen of martyrs, but Islam flourished ever more." You know, the sentence of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi is about the victory of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam through his martyrdom. Muslims and non-Muslims alike have acknowledged throughout the history that Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam saved Islam from destruction by sacrificing his life. Yazid had been successful in winning over the allegiance of the great majority of Muslims, and the rest of the Muslim world was in state of moral slumber. The principles of Islam were being plundered. The Sunnah of the Holy Prophet was being tampered with. The phony traditions were being concocted to justify the rule of Yazid. It was the singular sacrifice of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam and his faithful followers that shook the Islamic world out of its slumber. Karbala, Allahumma arzuqna Karbala, 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 Allahumma arzuqna Karbala. The Muslims were forced to ask themselves why the beloved grandson of the Holy Prophet had been murdered so brutally. It then dawned upon the people what the true nature of Yazid and his supporters was. Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, by challenging Yazid and in the process laying down his life, changed the world and reshaped human destiny forever. Yazid, and indeed all future despots, were put on notice that they would not be tolerated, and the truth and justice would be upheld and would ultimately succeed, regardless of the costs. The Iranian revolution that uprooted and overthrew an unjust government and the liberation of Lebanon from foreign occupation are two of the more recent examples of these principles laid down by Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. In fact, what Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi meant in his speech was the great purpose of the movement of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, which was to spread the real incarnation of Islam to the Muslim world. May Allah bless the soul of this great man.
Every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio. in the limelight.
While many U.S. lawmakers have justified anti-BDS laws as fighting discrimination, an article published in the Harvard Law Review found that anti-BDS laws are not backed by a valid anti-discrimination interest. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Middle East Eye has covered this story and tells us more. 12 Republican U.S. senators have introduced a bill which would ban federal contracts with entities that boycott Israel. The lead sponsor of the bill, dubbed the Countering Hate Against Israel by Federal Contractors Act, Senator Jim Risch, claimed in a press release that businesses who boycott Israel only seek to normalize anti-Semitism. The same bill was introduced in the House of Representatives in July of last year, but it's still in the House Committee on Oversight and Accountability, pending a vote. Last February, the House passed an anti-boycott act which prohibits American nationals from taking part in boycotts organized by any international governmental organization against U.S. allies. The IGO Anti-Boycott Act raised concerns among followers of the Palestinian-led boycott, divestment and sanctions movement, the BDS movement, which existed for 15 years and aims to pressure Israel to comply with international laws. The Chai Act is a federal-level application of numerous anti-BDS laws that have been passed at state levels. According to Newsweek magazine, some 28 U.S. states currently outlaw agencies from working with firms that boycott Israel, while 6 others passed similar bills in the form of executive orders. The American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, has said anti-BDS laws violate the First Amendment right to boycott. The Columbia Journal of Transnational Law has also published an article examining arguments justifying anti-BDS laws and found that many of the anti-BDS laws likely run afoul of the First Amendment by imposing unconstitutional conditions on government contractors and/or beneficiaries of public funding. While many lawmakers have justified anti-BDS laws as fighting discrimination, an article published in the Harvard Law Review found that anti-BDS laws are not backed by a valid anti-discrimination interest. The latest development comes as Israel has become increasingly isolated since October of last year with its war on Gaza. Israel launched a devastating war on Gaza on 7th of October last year after the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas waged a surprise operation on Al-Aqsa Storm against the occupying regime in response to earlier Israeli atrocities and crimes. Since then, the United States has supplied the Tel Aviv regime with more than 10,000 tons of military equipment and used its veto power against several United Nations Security Council resolutions that called for an immediate ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. Turkey's Anadolu News Agency has also covered the same story. More than 20 members of the European Union Parliament have called for a trade ban with the illegal Israeli settlements, emphasizing the need for a major shift in European Union policy following the groundbreaking decision of International Court of Justice, the ICJ, regarding Israel's unlawful annexation of Palestinian lands and its crimes in the Gaza Strip. The 21 members of the European Parliament, in a Thursday, 25th of July letter to the President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, and Josep Borrell, the High Representative of the European Union demanded that the 27 member states of the EU bloc must align itself with the findings of the United Nations highest court. Recently, the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, ruled that Israel's ongoing occupation of Palestinian territory is illegal and must be terminated as quickly as possible. The parliamentarians called for an European Union ban on trade and settlements based on the ICJ opinion that states must take steps to prevent trade or investment relations that assist in the maintenance of the illegal situation created by the Israeli regime in the occupied Palestinian territories. The letter read, "The International Court of Justice's historic opinion must be regarded as a pivotal moment for the European Union to recalibrate its policy towards Israel, set as to bring about the end of its unlawful occupation, enable a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, ensure freedom and safety for both peoples, and resolutely defend the international legal order." The letter comes at a time when the catastrophic Israeli genocidal war in Gaza has killed close to 40,000 Palestinians so far, along with putting millions of others on the brink of famine. Meanwhile, Australia on Thursday, 25th of July, implemented sanctions and travel restrictions on illegal Israeli settlers who have been charged with committing violent offences against Palestinians in the West Bank, which is under an illegal Israeli occupation. Announced by Foreign Minister of Australia, Penny Wong, the sanctions were directed at seven Israeli settlers and a youth hardline settler group, Hilltop Youth, which is known for setting up new illegal outposts over their involvement in settler violence against Palestinians. The Australian Foreign Minister, Penny Wong, said in a statement, "The individuals sanctioned today have been involved in violent attacks on Palestinians. This includes beating, sexual assault and torture of Palestinians, resulting in serious injury and in some cases death." The extremist group Hilltop Youth consists of hardline extremist and religious nationalist youths who establish illegal outposts without an Israeli legal basis in the occupied West Bank. The Australian Foreign Minister Penny Wong said the entity sanctioned is a youth group that is responsible for inciting and perpetrating violence against Palestinian communities. On 27th of June, the group's far-right owner, Mayor Ettinger, was earlier sanctioned by Canada when it announced sanctions against seven Israeli settlers and five organizations for their violent and destabilizing actions against Palestinian civilians and their property in the occupied West Bank. On Wednesday, 24th of July, the Norwegian government also aligned with the European Union to implement sanctions against extremist illegal Israeli settlers in Palestinian territories. That measure included freezing their financial assets and imposing travel restrictions to the country. Israeli settlers have escalated their violent actions and military incursions into the occupied West Bank ever since the Zionist regime launched its genocidal war in Gaza in October of last year. The MediaLine website has also covered the same story and tells us more. Pro-Palestine protesters were on the streets of Washington, D.C. on Wednesday, 24th of July, condemning Israel's barbaric campaign of death and destruction and genocide in the occupied Gaza Strip. And at the same time, Benjamin Netanyahu was addressing U.S. Congress. Several thousands of demonstrators gathered near the Capitol Demonstrators with signs reading "Arrest Netanyahu and end all U.S. aid to Israel" chanted "Free, free Palestine" following a sit-in at a congressional office building that resulted in several arrests the previous day. Benjamin Netanyahu aims to bolster Washington's support for Israel's war machine. Protest organizers had planned to obstruct his path to the building, which led to the police forcibly dispersing those blocking an intersection. The organizers of the sit-in announced that six intersections leading to the Capitol were claimed by the Palestinian people.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to Islamic Upbringing on IRIB English Radio. I'm Zainab, your host, and I'm thrilled to be here. In this program, we'll be diving into the world of Islamic upbringing, exploring the challenges and triumphs of raising children in harmony with the principles of Islam. From answering your questions to discussing most important topics in parenting, our discussions will be grounded in the wisdom of Quran, Hadith, and the teachings of noble imams. Today we are joined by Brother Miqdad, who's a research scholar in the House of Ilmi of Qom. Let's welcome him. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah to you and to all the brothers and sisters who are listening.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you so much for coming, and we are excited to be here with you today again to benefit from your valuable insights. So, you know, Brother Miqdad, there are teenagers, there are these young children who love to make friends, who love to be joined by friends, who love to be loved by friends, actually. So we would want you to discuss the topic of friendship with us today.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, when we discuss issues related to teenagehood, and as we want to call them, young adults as well, out of respect for this very important journey that these 11, 12, up until 17-year-olds go through. One of the things, one of the discussions that comes at this age is the discussion on friendship, the discussion on social interactions with the same gender.
Right.
So we're talking about boys having friends amongst their boy circle and girls having friends amongst their sisters or girl sections, and having friends with their girls and sisters together. One of the things that we see, and those who have had any interaction with teenagers will realize that friendship at this age is very, very important. And they count it as amongst the most important things in their lives. Very difficult for them to detach from their friends. Very important for them to have acceptance from their friends, to be part of a group. They build their social identity based on their friendship. They're heavily influenced by their friends and also heavily influence their friends as well. And at times, we've seen as well that this can be gone to extremes as well, where you have mental health issues that stem from an extreme level of friendship, which is not what we really want to see and is not correct. And so
It's a very important discussion when it comes to friendship, the whole discussion of peer pressure over here. And generally the emotional attachment to another person that comes at this age is one that we need to discuss, we need to evaluate, and we need to use it. Because like any other traits that youth have and teenagers have at this age, the potential for it to be used in a positive way is very big.
Right.
But also at the same time, it also can lead to, you want to call it disasters, or you want to call it mistakes, or extremes that would be harmful for the growth of a teenager. And therefore, this important discussion needs to be looked at. It needs to be implemented as well. And more important is parents need to be equipped with skills on how to deal with this issue related to friendship of their teenagers.
Right. Let's take a short break and we'll be back in a while. Dear listeners, don't go anywhere.
IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5 years old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. Englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic upbringing, and we are discussing the most important topic among the youth, and that is friendship. Well, Brother McDowell said friendship is important, and young adults do count it as important. They consider it very important to have acceptance from their friends. They build their social identity on the ideas of their friends. They are heavily influenced, and they heavily influence their friends. There's this emotional attachment which needs to be evaluated, and there can be extreme disasters as well. So we need to look on this topic. So far we discussed that, and the stage is again yours, Brother McDowell.
So one of the introductory points that I want to mention over here is how we deal with teenagers is very important. So take this example this discussion that we're having right now on friendship, or any other discussion that we can have on dealing with teenagers. It has some important points that I'd like to mention before we enter the discussion.
Right.
The first one is that it's very important to realize that teenagehood is a period of life that many events happen in this period. And it's one that changes a person a lot. It's like a rough sea.
I don't know,
for those who've been on a sea in the ocean, for example, the waves can be very dangerous. But at the same time, we have to realize that whilst teenagers are going through all this, it's important that parents are equipped with the right skills to be able to navigate through this, to be able to overcome the waves and keep their control to navigate the sea despite the waves. And this is very important. I feel that many parents, although they have a lot of love for their children, they have sincere intentions, the reason why perhaps they fail or they lack a good relationship with their teenagers is because they don't know what teenagers are going through. They don't understand what teenagers are going through. Or they don't know the techniques of how to deal with teenagers. They don't understand the methodology of dealing with teenagers. And you find this all the time. So, for example, when we come to the discussion on seeking independence, you find that a child at this age, a teenager, wants to make a decision on buying a pair of clothes, for example. right? And so imagine the scenario. He comes home and says, Mom, I want some money. I want to go buy a pair of clothes with my friends. And Mom says, your clothes are fine. If you need more clothes, Dad will come with you and you can buy with your dad.
Right.
The child gets really upset, slams the door, comes back the next day, and he's got a new pair of clothes on, or a new pair of trousers on. And Mom asks, where did you get those trousers from? Oh, he goes, I bought them. I took some loan that I will pay back myself when I work. So you don't have to worry about it.
Yes.
You see, over here, the mother didn't know how to deal with this teenager that wanted a bit of
independence
and be able to make their own decision. And so their intention was very good, but they couldn't have this fruitful communication. And this is the third point I want to go to, is that many of these traits of teenagers, when faced with them, parents have to direct those energies, not confront it.
Right.
See, when it comes to teenagehood, we don't confront teenagers, right? When they want independency, when they want to do things their own way, when they want to make their own decision, when they want attention towards themselves, they want to dress in a particular way, put their hair in a particular way. It's important that we realize that this energy, we can't counter it. I'll come back to the example of the wave, right? Imagine when you're in the sea, you never try to go on the wave directly hitting the wave,
right?
You try to navigate over the wave in a way that you can go forward. Whilst the wave is over there.
Safe. Right. We'll discuss more with you, Brother Meghdad, after a short break. Dear listeners, don't go anywhere.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We're with Brother Meghdad discussing friendship in teenagers. Well, we said that dealing with teenagers is very important. Parents have to realize that teenage is a period of many, many rough events, and it's parents should be equipped with the skills to navigate things correctly. Brother Meghdad said it's very important to learn how to direct things rather than confronting them. So, yes, Brother Meghdad.
So when we look at friendship, you realize that friendship is a need that children have at this age. If you remember our discussion previously on the needs of children, one of the needs that teenagers build, it's there previously as well. The social need in children is there. You find children even at the age of 5, 6, 7, 8. They want to play with their friends. They're having a lot of good time with their friends.
Right.
But over here, when we talk about teenagers, this attachment to friend changes. It's no more, I want to play with my friends. It builds a more emotional attachment.
Right.
You find six-year-olds, for example, they want to have a very good time with their friends and they will have loads of fun. But when they're away from their friends, I mean, the communication is not that much. I mean, how many six-year-olds, you know, want to stay in touch with their friends when they're at home, for example? Or how much conversation do they have about their private life, about how they feel? None of that. It's just we play together, we have a good football time together, or we play on the computer together, or we do some interaction together in terms of a project together or an activity together. But suddenly when you come to teenagers, friendship takes a new meaning now.
Yes.
Friendship is something that is a strong emotional attachment. They value this friendship for many different things. One is to be able to speak to them about their private matters, about how they feel. This is something that you wouldn't see in children before this. But
yes,
teenagers now are willing to share things that they would not share with anyone. They share with their friends. And also things that they don't share with their parents, they would share with their friends.
Right.
Friendship is also a new... it takes a dimension greater than just the period that they're together.
Right.
Even when they're not with their friends, they still try to stay in communication with them through the normal gadgets and the devices that we have and the communication methods of today.
Right.
But also in their mind, they're thinking about their friends. See, a six-year-old doesn't really care what his friend's going through when they're on holiday.
Yes.
Right. But a 12-year-old, a 13-year-old is thinking about what my friend is going through right now.
Right.
That attachment remains even in the absence of a friend. If that relationship is built, then the thinking and the stress and the attachment remains even when they're not together physically. And if it's not controlled, if it's not managed, if it's not directed in the right way, what happens is that this can lead to some issues, some problems, some difficulties later on, some extreme attachments that would kind of derail the growth and the tarbiya of this teenager.
Right. So we said that friendship is a need and young children do feel this social need. They are emotionally attached than just playing with their friends. Friendship has a new meaning in their lives when they grow up and they have strong emotional attachments and they speak more about their private matters and they prefer and they are comfortable with their friends. And if it's not controlled, it can lead to disasters. Until another episode, take good care of yourself. In case you want to listen to our previous episodes, go back to our official website, which is www.parstoday.ir/en. There's a tab, Call of Islam, and there you can search our programs, Islamic Upbringing, and you can get back to the archive of our programs. Thank you so much for listening. Until another episode, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines this hour. The leader of the Islamic Revolution endorses Masoud Pezeshkian as Iran's ninth president, authorizing him to form his administration. Israel's airstrikes and artillery fire continue to pound various areas across Gaza as the death toll from the regime's genocide passes 39,300. And the people of Venezuela go to the polls to choose the country's president for the next 6 years. Thanks for joining us. The leader of the Islamic Revolution has called on the new Iranian administration to engage with other countries, but to rely on domestic capabilities. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei made the remarks after endorsing Masoud Pezeshkian as Iran's ninth president. The leader said the administration must give priority to ties with neighbors, countries that expand Iran's diplomatic reach, including in Asia and Africa, and governments that have helped Iran against foreign pressure. Ayatollah Khamenei also called for attention to the economy and the livelihood of people as a key domestic priority. He said that everyone must avoid division and schism and called on parliament and the judiciary to help the new administration fulfill its objectives. Also speaking during the endorsement ceremony, Iran's new president, Masoud Pezeshkian, said the country can overcome its problems with convergence and unity.
Only through convergence and law adhering within the administration will be able to overcome the difficulties and in this way realize people's wishes. A society that abides by the law can see the administration becoming more powerful and play the crucial role for the development of the country. In order to realize this goal,